this at first and then ultimately John, was what if we have an 11-year-old girl who's moved across the country, but she's actually not the main character, she's the setting. Because inside her head are her emotions that help her deal with everyday life. And it was pretty much just that simple of a concept. I didn't really have a story yet. That came from working with Josh Cooley and Ronnie Del Carmen, all the amazing story talents that we have, slowly developed over the next 4 years. But we all kind of know that it doesn't have to be perfect. We're going to make a lot of adjustments and refinements as we go.
So John Lasseter actually couldn't conceptualize how you were going to literally wrap your head around the concept of what you had pitched.
No, he said later he realized, he said, this is such a cool idea. It's got a lot of complexity and a lot of potential. It's also going to be really hard. And I didn't really see that at the time. I was too taken by the fun of it.
I remember when we first did our first kind of pitch / screening to the rest of the group there, the Brain Trust. I remember it was Brad Bird. He said, this is a great idea. I'm glad you guys are doing it. You know, it was a tough nut to crack, right?
Well, who's got questions in the audience? Let's start right over. Fred, you go first, buddy.
Pete and Jonas, I'm sure you can both talk about this, but I noticed a recurring theme across Pixar movies, really embodied in Inside Out, which is saying goodbye to your child. Bing Bong has to let go of Bing Bong to move on. She has to accept that the Minnesota memories are sad now that she moved. Is saying that theme, saying goodbye to your childhood, something the artists at Pixar talk about a lot, or is it more subconscious that seems to seep into a lot of the movies?
I don't think we talk about it verbally. We talk about it through the work.
Yeah, I mean, it is important to us. I mean, it is a driver for us.
I mean, you're right. It seems to be, like, you'll come in and it's like, have you ever read Peter Pan? I was reading it to the kids, and it is so poignant and so moving. It's something that we're taken by, for sure.
Yeah, there's like almost nothing more emotional to me than thinking about it. I'm a parent now. My kids are 9 and 7 and 3, so they're younger. And I guess I've always been drawn to those stories, and it just feels like that is common at Pixar. Maybe it's because we actually act like we're 10-year-olds all the time. I don't know what it is, but there's... Pixar does feel a little bit like this Neverland we've built, and that it's, I don't know, maybe the Lost Boys or something.
I think
it's just important to us, and Bing Bong does, that's why that part was so important to me, and when we first animated that, it really got me, because it felt like, oh, that's the statement I kind of been looking for, you know.
I think the other thing that affects us is our own, we're trying to put our own life experiences up on the screen. I don't think there's been anything that has impacted me near as strongly as having been a parent. And so that experience just continues to inspire and challenge and move us in ways that everybody can resonate with.
Yeah, I agree.
Question right over here.
Could you talk a little bit about picking 5 emotions to go with it inside the head rather than 6 or 4? Is there a mathematical reason for that? And also, is there some of the voice, I mean, in the case of like Lewis Black, did he just cast himself?
Yeah. Yeah, the very beginning pitch, I think I pitched optimism, which is, we learned later, not really an emotion, and joy. I had fear and anger and some other ones. And we realized, man, we don't really know anything about this. So we did a lot of research, and that's where this came from. There is no consensus among scientists about how many emotions there actually are. Some say 3, some say 27. Most are somewhere in the middle. So we realized, well, we get to kind of make this up. So we arrived at 5 mainly because it's a nice odd number. It felt like a good crowd, enough contrast and conflict between them, but not so big that you're like, wait, who's that again? You know, Schadenfreude? Okay, lost track of... So, you know, if we were to represent all 27, my brain was hurting thinking of writing for all these characters. We ended up at these 5 largely because of the work of Dr. Paul Ekman, who is one of the consultants on the show. And he had originally, back in the 70s, posited 6. It was our 5 plus surprise. And we felt surprise as a cartoon is probably fairly similar to fear. So we jettisoned that one, and that's how we ended up with the 5.
Right over here.
Hi.
Pixar and went to the event that you guys had a few years ago.
Yeah.
Everything that I thought it would be, and it was really awesome. So, say that first.
Thank you.
Thanks.
have a question for both of you guys. You guys make such amazing animated films together. Is that something you consciously do together when you're going to pitch a new movie that you want to be as a team to make films with Pixar? And why do you like to make people cry?
Those are related, maybe. I mean, I think we found as we were working, we both kind of grew up at Pixar. I've been there 20 years, Pete's there longer, going back to the first Toy Story. And we found along the way, I mean, Pixar's a place that it's just made of a lot of really cool people. And it's amazing place. Just really, we're spoiled with all the talent that surrounds us. But we just realized we love kind of the same movies and love those Disney movies of the 40s and 50s and, mm-hmm. and 30s of just that golden age. Again, sort of echoing what you were asking about, just that feeling we had when we were kids that we didn't want to ever lose, going to Disneyland for the first time and all those things. And I think as we talked and started to work together, even back on Monsters, we were sort of craving a similar movie, which was completely different than the movie, whatever it was, different than the movie we did last. That was something we talked a lot about.
Yeah.
And even finishing the film Up, which came out 6 years ago, the very first thing was like, how can we do something completely different than that? We were very proud of that. But it is always about character and emotion and that feeling. And so, I don't know, if we don't sit around consciously going, let's make a great movie. I mean, we hope that happens, obviously.
Right.
But I think it's just like, what do we want to see? What did we love seeing when we were kids? What do we want to take our families to? What are we going to be proud of? Let's aim for that. And I'm lucky. Pete thinks them up. I just have to figure out how to make them. And so I feel very honored that this is my job.
I think we have similar tastes and different but complementary skills and a mutual respect for each other and what each other brings to the show. I feel like, man, I can't see how I could be able to do these without Jonas. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but you know,
it's
I think it's been a really great relationship.
But it's also not just us; it's our key collaborators.
Yeah.
Like, I'll tell a quick story about Michael Giacchino because he scored both films. We got into the car. This is the first scoring day on Up, you know, back in 2009, and I knew we were going to get along. Michael had done some of the films at Pixar, but we'd never really worked with them. And we get in the car at Warner Brothers after we're done scoring that first day. We're going to do what you do. You go to Disneyland after you're done scoring the movie.
Of course.
And so we're driving down the freeway. We get in Michael's car, and he turns on his car, and he'd had some CD. Blasting out of the stereo was the theme of the Muppet Show, right? And I'm in the back, and Pete says, "Oh, wow, I was listening to that same disc on the way to the airport." And I thought, oh, my God. What two cars on the planet Earth had those two songs in, right? And those two guys. There's stuff like that. It's like we all somehow were born to somehow mess around with all this stuff and try to make things out of it. Totally random, I'm sorry, but that popped into my head.
Bruce Kirkland from the Toronto Sun.
Hey, Bruce.
And I'd like to go back to the five emotions, but in this case, there was a reference to Lewis Black casting himself.
Oh, yeah.
But I'd love if you talked about the casting of each of the five and why those particular actors are suitable for creating those emotions, because without those performances, this movie never would have worked, obviously. So that was a crucial linchpin in the entire production. So specifics would be most welcome.
Great.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of the lines on paper, if you read the script, they're like, it's sort of funny. But just when these particular actors bring them to life, it's somehow so specific and so wonderful. That it's fantastic. Lewis Black was one that even as I was pitching the concept, I would say, you know, imagine the fun we're going to have when it comes to casting. We could get people like Lewis Black as Anger, and people go, oh, yeah,
of course,
I get that.
Yeah.
So when we cast him, Jonas called him.
Yeah, I called Lewis through our casting department at Pixar, and we pitched him the movie. We wanted him to play Anger. And he immediately, like, I think what he said, it's like, great, real stretch casting, guys, brilliant.
Like, mocked it was a hard time
for calling him, you know.
Yeah.
That was even perfect. He was so great. He's not only just, to me, he does one of the great lines in the movie, too. He's got that great line where he just says, you know, what have we done? And he says it in a non-Lewis Black way that has a punch. He's just a great actor.
Talk about Bill.
Bill was, Bill came on pretty early. Bill, I was just a fan of Bill Hader. since, you know, Saturday Night Live. And it turned out Bill was a fan of Pixar. We didn't know it. He shows up one day at Pixar, and our casting director calls and says, Bill Hader's in the atrium. Does anyone want to go have coffee with him? What? Yeah. Bill Hader, should we go down there? And there's Bill Hader drinking coffee by himself. And he had, on his own dime, flown up just because he loves animation. And he loves it. I mean, Bill knows more about movies than anyone I've ever known,
yeah.
And animated or otherwise. And he's not only at Pixar, we introduce ourselves to him, and he says, oh my God, what? Is that Ralph Eggleston? Like our production designer that no one would know unless you watched side three of the Wall-E Blu-ray, you know, something. And he watched everything and knew everybody, and we just fell in love with him. And he came on to write with us, actually, because he's such a great storyman. He's a great writer, and he was so much fun in the story room, and we just went through the script, and he started developing voices, and he kind of leaned towards fear, and he was kind of perfect at it. He really brought this sort of, I don't know, Don Knotts, Sheriff of Mulberry, you know, like quick turn on a dime that made us laugh, and he fit.
So just to run through the rest, because I know we have limited time. Disgust, we struggled with a lot, because we weren't sure whether she should be disgusting or disgusted. And once we arrived at disgusted, Mindy's voice came up, and she, again, takes lines that are like fine writing and makes them amazing to listen to. She, like most of the cast, we would come with the script and I would say, do you have any other ideas for this? Go ahead and play around. And she would come up with little alternate lines and asides and added a ton to both the character and the film. Sadness was one that early on we actually had that character as male in the very first versions. And then as the film went on, we realized, well, we have too many guys in this movie, especially if it's taking place in a girl's head. And I think that was about the same time when you had found...
I saw her in the movie Bad Teacher.
Yeah,
and
Phyllis Smith.
And she was just so funny. I think hesitant was what... Because you had written her more like a crybaby.
Yeah, she was showing up...
Always crying.
Crying.
Which was funny, but then in Bad Teacher, she was hesitant and couldn't even, you know... order a chicken sandwich. She's like, I'll have the chicken sandwich. And everything had a question mark, and that felt right, and it worked, and that's how we ended up playing the character, and she just nailed it. And of course, Joy.
Joy was the last one to be cast, and it was the most difficult of any of the characters to write for because she had a tendency of being really annoying. You know, if you write someone who is always chipper and upbeat and, come on, guys, we can do this, it just kind of got like, you don't want to sock that person. And so Amy was able to put that in some way that made it just entertaining. It was not insufferable. It was, you root for her. And I think there were a couple other smaller writing clues that helped break that open a little bit too, but we can talk about that extra if we need to.
Speaking of Amy, that's what I understand that you and Amy actually sat down and sort of went through the script before you started working on it.
Yeah, that was our first day with her. I don't remember whose idea this was, but instead of recording right away, we spent the whole day reading through the script, one sequence at a time. And then Amy would start narrowing in on certain lines, not just for her, but some of the other characters as well. And so she's got such a brilliant writing mind as well as being an amazing performer. We took advantage of that.
Right after.
Sort of building off of what you had mentioned earlier with the casting, Riley has both male and female voices in her head. Mom's got all females, dad's got all males.
Uh-huh.
How did you arrive at this decision? Was it just purely based on casting, or how did this all break down?
It was largely based on clarity, frankly, because that scene presented itself. Ronnie Del Carmen wrote and boarded that. And then when we tried it with a mix of male and female and moms and dads, it just got confusing. So you're cutting from four locations, 18 characters, and you're like, wait, where am I again? So we just went for the obvious of all dads have mustaches, all moms have the glasses and the hair, so you instantly know where you are. And that just made it work a lot better.
We thought of it like if it was an SNL sketch, it would just be the prop house would come in and make it read.
Yeah.
Mark Hughes with Forbes. This film speaks very strongly to an older kind of target demographic than a lot of animated films, Pixar films, have in the past. And I was wondering if, when you started on this project, was there ever a point where you were imagining the main character being a younger character than she turned out to be in the film?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, we always thought, I think because that age felt right at 11, again, thinking about Ellie, you know, your daughter, that really felt like the fork in the road for most kids. I mean, obviously we have versions of where we see her grow up and stuff, but it always felt about like the right age. I don't know, and there's something about my kids are younger, and they like seeing little older kids in movies, you know? Mm-hmm. I always think about like even the Spielberg movies of the 80s, like I was always a hair younger than those kids, mm-hmm. That's like, I thought that was cool. We didn't really talk about that, yeah. But I've always thought that was interesting.
We did kind of hedge up and down at around 11, just trying to find exactly the right age where you're becoming an adult, you know, because parents would say, oh, my 9-year-old is already doing that, or some people would say my 13-year-old. So 11 seemed like a good target. But
yes, I think it's interesting that in Disney's Big Hero 6, San Francisco was cool, and in this one you successfully managed to make it pretty downer there. could you tell a bit about making San Francisco look quite a downer?
Well, one of the things that seems to happen is that even memories are affected by the way you feel today. So if you're walking around depressed and it's a beautiful sunny day out, you're going to notice all the things that reinforce your emotion. So we tried to make the city reflect the way Riley felt about herself and her environment. So there were things, we definitely emphasized certain elements of San Francisco. The wires overhead and the graffiti and the sort of dirt to reinforce the adult kind of desaturated colors and the way she was feeling at the time. Of course, it's a beautiful city as well, and hopefully we got a little of that across as well.
But it made sense to us from a kid's point of view, and in contrast from where she was with all her friends. It had to, like, I love the first few shots as you drive in. It is sort of a picture postcard. But then when you get home, like, wah, wah, it's not what she thought. So that we needed to stay there to kind of amplify that.
Actually, I want to bring up a point that you mentioned Toy Story. This year, November 22nd, to be exact, marks the 20th anniversary of the movie that started it all, Toy Story. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's it, so is. Proud of that.
My question about that, in 20 years, it's unbelievable. My question is, the luxury that you have at Pixar, this brain trust of, you know, you guys and Lasseter and Stanton, mm-hmm. Lee Umbridge,
yeah, Lee.
This luxury to try things out, see what works, what doesn't. How do you know what you've got, what you do with this?
It's usually a collection of smaller, like, building blocks. That's a hard question to answer. I think, everybody chips in stuff. Frankly, you could show Casablanca in that room and we would find things wrong with it and chip it apart. So a lot of it is schedule, and you're like, okay, this has to be done. Everybody knows the schedule. Everyone knows where we are, and it's respectful of that. So on the, you know, 9th screening, people aren't going to say, why emotions? You know, they're going to have more specific kind of targeted notes. So I think that's, like, everybody is kind of in the same seat, essentially.
There are moments, though, when you see it, I think, because what I do is we have screenings every 3 months, and we invite that group in. They're a very critical group. But we also bring in, like, the security guards and payroll and people that aren't necessarily born to give notes. And then we hear their notes as well. And when you aggregate that, you sort of experience what the audience might think. And there are moments along the way, and I remember one on this one. It was the dinner scene. It was the first time that was really boarded, where I could see Lasseter and I could see Lee, and I could see them in silhouette busting up.
Yeah.
And then, like, okay, that's cool. Like, that got him. And it wasn't even right yet. It wasn't even in the right spot. But you could start to see through the weeds what the movie might be. And they're a pretty tough audience. So when you have John Lasseter, you know, okay, that must be touching something in the pulse of the world. And so then you dig there, you know.
Just got the mic over here. Yes?
Hi, Joe Corey with Geek Dad. Question, Joy is the captain of Riley's mind. And I noticed that Mom's mind has sadness in the center seat, and Dad has anger, and I wonder how much I should read into that.
Fair enough, fair question.
Well, if the shoes fit. We noticed in real life people do have tendencies, right? There are people, friends of mine, who more likely be sad or depressed or angry or whatever. So we felt like we were touching on something that was truthful. We also had an earlier version where Joy was kind of in charge of the happy childhood, and she believed that her time was going to come to an end. And so we wanted to further prove that by showing that other characters around were not led by Joy. That, of course, worked itself kind of out of the picture, but we ended up with keeping with it, just not even really commenting on it, just as a way of kind of fleshing out the world and making it a little more dimensional.
Who's got the mic on this side? Yes.
Some of them are obvious, but how do you determine the color and the appearance of each character?
Yeah, that was kind of fun because it was such an abstract process. When Pete had said he wanted these characters to feel like our emotions, look like our emotions feel, which was hard for the art department to then chase down what that would be. We didn't want them to be little people or little Muppets. Or, what are they? And Albert Lozano, our character art director, came up with this great little, remember that just simple drawing of shapes, and I thought it was really cool. It was just each one of them is a different shape. So Joy was a star, and she was really this golden, illuminated, like, almost like a sparkler, like an explosion. Even her body language, she's always out. And Sadness was a teardrop, so even the shape and color and her hair sort of almost a waterfall, thing. Fear was just a raw nerve. He just drew like this straight line. Like, he is tight and conservative, and he's wound up. Anger is a brick, this immovable briquette or something, that could blow his top. He just was a square. And disgust was a stalk of broccoli.
Yeah.
He just drew that like our kids would be disgusted by that. And that was just this metaphoric way to attack them all. And they sort of retained that shape and color as they went. I mean, purple really not so much, I guess.
Yeah, but I remember having discussions about, like, obviously you say, I feel blue. Yeah. So some of them were a little more obvious in terms of colors. Other ones, like you were saying, purple for fear just kind of, we chose purple because it was left over, right? It's a good color that kind of rounds out the cast. Not so much the purple evokes fear, I think.
But we were joking, like, we hope someday that's the grammar. Like, yeah. I'm so afraid I'm purple. Like, someone double stick somehow.
But right, it was
back. You have the mic?
She said answer her question.
Okay, good.
My question is about the abstract thinking. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you're going to give parents a guide to explaining abstract thinking to their kids maybe.
We'd write a little pamphlet.
Yeah, we should. So you want to understand this movie. No, yeah, it was one of those that as soon as we came up with that concept, I was like, we have to do abstract thought. And it was one of the early sequences that even as the rest of the film didn't work, even John was like, that one's good. That was gold, you know. Yeah. So it what it does for us is just take advantage of what animation can do, really pushing the visuals. And it fit, like, as we did the research, we found out abstraction is something that is a little more advanced thinking. It's usually like age 6 or 7 when kids are slowly able to kind of conceive of concepts that are not like physical objects in front of them. So we figured this was a more recent development in Riley's brain.
I haven't.
Bing Bong doesn't really know what it does because he's like a 3-year-old,
I haven't told you this, but I use my kids all the time. My 3-year-old, I asked him if he liked that part. He called it the changing tunnel.
Oh, cool.
So, to a 3-year-old, he just thinks it's a dangerous tunnel where you change.
Yeah.
And like, maybe when he's older, he'll understand what that is. But I didn't explain it anymore. I'm like, that's actually a good description.
Yeah.
Right over here.
Hello, my name is Eva with Tech Life Magazine, and I notice at the center of emotion is the emotion console.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know, how did the idea for the emotion console come, as well as the theme of, spaceship, driving those emotions?
We, from the very beginning, we thought of the emotions as being some sort of controls. Because I feel like that's probably how they would work, right? In order to affect us emotionally. And early on, we made it much more specific. We had like heart rate, body temperature, kind of the things that emotions actually do physically affect
butterflies
us.
Butterflies we
have. Right, butterflies in the stomach. Spine tingle, stuff. And then we thought, well, that's maybe a little too, like you wouldn't need to know that as an audience member. So we tried to make it more evocative of what might be in an 11-year-old girl. It's got a sense of fun and play to it, but it's also practical and physical. And the idea of each emotion, I don't know if you notice this, when they touch the console, it changes color to kind of take on it's like those fancy cars when they can kind of sense when a certain person sits in it, the seat adjusts, so it's a little like that. It adjusts depending on who's driving.
But it was really this attempt to be. We didn't want it to be too science fiction. You can imagine this movie without any visuals, reading it, it did sort of lean that way. So we worked really hard to make it whimsical and fun, like the mind of a little girl. And of course, then once we had that grammar, then you could be like, dad's is more of a NORAD computer, you know, old school mm-hmm. coffee cups on it. You can kind of echo that. And there's just, we hope, just enough logic in the buttons and the way it would work that you would just buy that it was. And when we'd get too literal, it almost feel robotic, like they were driving. And so it was just really, I mean, we looked at, you mentioned the ship. I remember even looking at, like, the Millennium Falcon. Like, you just buy it. There's a throttle. You kind of don't need to know more than
what
that.
I always
just sort of accepted those buttons worked and did things. And we kind of wanted the similar grammar, but in a fun way. We had talked with the art department as they started coming up with it, that and the whole room, that it was almost like this combination of It's a Small World and an Apple Store. That's what we kind of kept saying, that, like, it was whimsical and whirligigs, and same with the console, but it was also serious. It was just clinical enough to work and be functional and so forth.
That should remind me of the bridge of the Enterprise.
I mean, they're driving, so, you know, and there's the screen and
all that.
Yeah.
Right over here.
Joy has blue hair, and you pair her with sadness throughout the movie. Am I reading too much into that? Are they reflections of one another? And also, are you already planning now for Riley's teenage years?
Too scary.
Yeah, that'd be a horror film, and we're not brave enough.
No, we originally we had Joy with orange hair. The thinking was that every character would be kind of more or less monochromatic, with shades going one way or another. But then there was something that just felt like Joy needed more dimensionality, more contrast. And so by giving her blue hair, which is complete opposite of yellow, it just rounded her out, made her the more complex visual character. And we did like the idea that she, even though she doesn't understand sadness, she's got an element of that in her right from the very beginning. A little foreshadowing.
There used to be an attraction at Epcot called Cranium Command that I loved as a kid. And kind of the basic premise is obviously isn't a military inside of a head running a whole body. But it kind of gives that feel a little bit of Cranium Command. Were you guys inspired by that attraction at all?
Well, we're huge fans of the park. I mean, Epcot. Oh, it's 45 minutes after you pitch this movie. I mean, we got to call a guy. We got to get a ride at Epcot. This has got to go back to Epcot. So yeah, we've been on that and loved that. I mean, you're right. You're right. A military command center.
I actually animated on that when I was at Disney in '89, and at the beginning there's a pre-show with all the heads. So I did a lot of the Xerox, and my head was in it. So that was kind of cool. I think it actually showcases kind of the difference between the approach. In this film, we really made it, well, let me talk about that one. It was like they were talking to the stomach and the heart and the liver and different things. In this one, we said, let's just differentiate from the body and make it the mind. And so that allowed us a whole different playground.
Last question right over here, Deb.
Guys, there's a great equitability on screen, both in the dialogue and visually, with each of the emotions, as well as an equitable codependency. How important was it to incorporate each of the emotions, give them their fair share, and show you can't really have one without the other?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously that was fairly central to the whole theme of the film. I think from the beginning we felt like, okay, Joy as a character is rootable. We all want to be happy. We want our children to be happy. Yet life is not always like that. It's full of disappointments and loss and difficulty, and so that's really where all the other emotions come in. We sort of knew that we wanted to talk about that from the beginning, but it took us a long time of finding just the right specifics to be able to dramatize it. Even pairing Joy with sadness, we've talked about before, she was initially paired with fear for quite a long time during the story development process. But fear didn't really provide Joy the message she needed to know. At the end of the film, we wanted her to go back and do something that she could have never done at the beginning of the film based on what she'd learned. And sadness, which at first seems like something to avoid, it's negative, we don't want it to be part of our lives, you come to realize that's actually an essential part of dealing with loss, right? It slows you down, it allows for recovery, it even exhibits signs to other people that you need help. And that really was, to me, like the central theme of this film is coming together and finding the most important thing on our, I think everyone would agree, is relationships with our family, with our friends. And sadness, though she seems negative, is really central to that community.
Before we let you go, since you are part of the Pixar Brain Trust, can you give us an update on Toy Story 4?
Toy Story 4.
No.
I was going to say there are toys in it.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you all for coming.
If I stay seated, we'll come out with a parcel of our
Thank you.